This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. This is Victoria Lupashko, one of the hosts for the Asian Studies channel at New Books Network. Today, we are here with Dr. Angie Chow, assistant professor of Chinese literature and film at the University of Victoria, British Columbia, Canada. Hello, Dr. Chow, and welcome to our channel.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me today.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to have you with us today. And you know, right off the bat, I want to thank you for agreeing to talk to us about your new book, Paris and the Art of Transposition, Early 20th Century Sino-French Encounters, published by University of Michigan Press in 2023. And, you know, as usual, I just want to start by getting to know you and your work better. And, you know, I was wondering whether you could tell us more about the trajectory that you had so far. Like, how did you come to this project? What got you interested in the early 20th century Sino-French artistic exchanges? You know, just to give a bit of context.
Yes. Thank you so much for that question, Victoria. It's funny looking back on this. You know, I grew up in this Chinese American family in the US. And when I think back on it, it's very much like a Francophile family. So my mom started taking French language lessons when I was young. And then this kind of led to her learning French cooking and a lot of family trips to France. So both me and my sister started taking French also in high school, and we were just completely enamored with French art and film and literature. So I ended up majoring in English literature in college and then minoring in French. And so during that time, I took some art history classes in pre-modern Chinese art. But my training is really as a literary comparatist. So you know, I'm not formally trained as this art historian. And then during graduate school in my PhD, I realized, wow, I don't know much about modern Chinese art or literature. So why is that? I didn't even know much about Chinese history, especially modern Chinese history, for that matter. So it led me to start taking courses in the Chinese history program at UCSD. And then I thought about, you know, how can I best use my language training to explore these possible connections between China and France. So I think my book is trying to fill that kind of gap there by adding some new voices to this field of French literature and art. Yeah, so that's a little bit about my background.
Amazing. And, you know, just like when I saw the title of the book and everything, and then now you're saying that you have a long history, you know, with French language, you know, I wish you were here in Quebec, you know, to help with, you know, teaching in French, you know, in the Asian Studies program.
It's a unique place, I'm sure.
It is. And, but, you know, hopefully in the future, we will have the opportunity to invite you here and to, you know, meet the students and talk to them, right?
Yeah, I'm actually coming out for ACLA in March. So
okay.
Are you going to AAS? at that.
No. I'm going to be here and then.
I'll come say hi. Like, it will just be nice to see you again in person. Yeah.
Absolutely. We have a plan. But, okay. You know, before we deviate too much from the book route, you know, I want to take us to the chapters, right, and the argument of the book. And I'll say that there are 6 chapters here, and they're accompanied by conclusions, and they both individually and collectively, and I'll quote here, reveal the impact of cultural displacement on artistic production by asking what is the role of modern art in promoting intercultural understanding and misunderstanding among Chinese intellectuals and the West in the early 20th century? What kind of expectations did Chinese writers and artists face in Paris? And what images of the modern Chinese artists circulated in China and France as a result of these encounters? End of quote. So, in other words, the book aims to shed light on the experiences of Chinese writers and artists in Paris by tracing the multitude of representations of the modern Chinese artists produced both by themselves for an increasingly global audience and also in dialogue with images of the artist that circulated in Chinese in literature and other forms of popular media. And that was another quote. So I'm curious to know more about the context of these exchanges between China and France, and also about the ways in which the image of the artist was multifariously constructed. What did this plurivalent image reveal to us about art and culture in general?
Yeah, thank you. So I think this image of the artist really speaks to the underlying issue of audience in terms of how these artists were positioning themselves on the global stage. So the art historian Craig Clunas has talked about this shift in how artists were perceived, whereas in classical art, it was more about the artist as a connoisseur versus like some shift in the early 20th century where it was more about showing the artist in action producing art specifically for this foreign audience. So, you know, my book is interested in thinking about literary or artistic value outside of these national frameworks and the canon. And I'm interested in using these five case studies to help us think about Chinese literature and art. So I think in some ways, these artists are exceptional in that they didn't really successfully get incorporated into any national canon. And, you know, my book is also asking, like, why should they be? So I think their work pushes us to think about these categories that are generally based on language or nation of origin. So for instance, Li Jingfa and his bilingual poetry in Chinese and French, you know, should they be included in this in these categories of French or Francophone or Sinophone literature? So in terms of like the existing scholarship on this period of exchange between China and France, it's generally focused on this political outcome. So, for instance, a lot of figures like Deng Xiaoping and Zhou Enlai, they also studied in France during this time. Then they came back to help found the Chinese Communist Party. So I was interested in what happened to some of the other people, you know, who were more disillusioned. They didn't necessarily want to participate in that. What are some other possible ways to talk about their contributions or implications of their experiences abroad, outside of being, you know, completely shaped or motivated by the political apparatus and national framework? So I think on a related note, you know, just like now, art always requires funding. So these collaborations and exchanges were made possible because of government policies in, you know, after World War I. And it makes sense that a lot of people who did study abroad wanted to go back to China and be able to work, you know, in the 1930s and 1940s. So we hear more about people like Ling Fengmian, who went back and founded China Art Academy, and Xu Beihong, father of modern Chinese painting. You know, but again, like, what about everyone else who didn't want to go back and be a part of that? Mm-hmm. So most of the five people I talk about in my book didn't go back to mainland China. And, you know, news traveled much slower back then, you know, by post or by word of mouth. But still, I think it was pretty clear to everybody who was abroad during that time that the political climate was changing in the 1930s and the 1940s in mainland China. So Xu Xu ended up in Hong Kong, Li Jingfa in the U.S., Chang Yu and Pan Yuliang stayed in France. So, you know, only Fu Lei stayed, and then he was persecuted during the Cultural Revolution. And so, you know, in Chinese history, you have that challenge of what to do with the socialist period and everything that was banned or forgotten, you know, after the 1940s until the 1980s. How do we recuperate some of those lost histories and experiences? And how do we talk about them now? And I think for art historians, they are maybe more aware of this than literary historians, in that so many of these paintings were destroyed, they were lost, they might never be recovered. Whereas some of these stories were published and censored, but, you know, some copies still exist. So this issue of censorship also explains why some of the scholarship and physical artwork by people like Chang Yu and Pan Yuliang were circulating in Taiwan and Hong Kong before they were rediscovered on the mainland. So, you know, to go back to your original question about the connection between art and culture, I'm hoping that by showing how the image of the artist circulates in art and literature, this is proof for why art historians should be interested in literature and vice versa. You know, why literary scholars should pay more attention to visual culture, because these kinds of conversations and collaborations, the dialogues that are really at the center of my book have existed for a long time. And I think that by looking more closely at these points of intersection, we can get a fuller, more complex picture of different kinds of artistic strategies and the challenges that some of these artists faced. And then they can inform the way that we think about intercultural collaborations and dialogues today. So, I mean, you know, just to say that, yes, some of these figures who actively tried to engage in cultural exchange, sometimes their projects didn't really work in terms of achieving critical or commercial or even popular success. So I'm trying to push us to think about, you know, how else can we think about their value outside of this idea of failure or success, or what are some alternative ways to determine their significance, you know, despite being overlooked or forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, since we're talking more and more about, you know, interconnectivity and, you know, networks of, you know, of culture and power and distribution of literature and art, I think it's very important to talk about these things and see what is not necessarily comprised in or sometimes boxed in to a certain, a frame, right? Yes, which would be absolutely. Going back, right? China, France, mm-hmm. France, China, and then pretty much that way. But if we extend the look, right, and we use a different concept, which is what your book does, right? And that's why it's so so fascinating and so exciting to discover it. And, you know, just to kind of continue the conversation on this in this line, the introduction, which is also chapter one, discusses the concept of transposition. And here, you know, I just wanted to hear a little bit more about it and to invite you to tell us how it conceptually organizes the way we see Sino-French exchanges, because I think it really continues your point, your earlier point, very well.
Yes, definitely. So, I mean, during this period of Sino-French exchange, there was a lot of hope and, you know, the excitement that you just described, also uncertainty, right? So this image of the modern artist in Chinese cultural production, it was kind of symbolic of the hope that art could somehow be used to establish intercultural understanding in France at the same time that this political conflict was increasing in China. So when the intellectuals were calling for dramatic reforms in Chinese language, literature, and art, these writers and artists were faced with this question of how to create modern art forms that were you know, noticeably distinct or different from the work of their predecessors. And this term transposition kept coming up in my research, especially in the context of this very abstract notion of Asian or Oriental sentiment or flavor. So this term Qingdiao, you know, how were these artists supposed to convey or be in dialogue with this perception of what Chinese culture or art should look like to the rest of the world? So in some ways, it should fit, you know, audience expectations about classical Chinese literature and art, but also these artists were in the midst of those debates exactly about what that modern Chinese art should look like. So how it should develop or adapt in the face of encounters with Western art. So, you know, on this literal aesthetic level, transposition is a practice that's associated primarily with music. And it can refer to a very technical way to think about change and adaptation for very practical reasons. So if you move from one musical instrument to another, say adapting piano music for the clarinet, or in singing, if you are moving things an octave just to accommodate a singer's vocal range, right? Mm-hmm. But as an aesthetic practice in France, it was also proposed by Baudelaire to talk about the connection between literature and visual art. So he has a saying about the best account of a painting is a sonnet or an elegy. And then composers like Debussy and Ravel were writing, you know, music that was inspired by poetry. So, you know, transposition is something that can be related to language, but I think what it does really well is that it challenges this notion that we have to be fluent or have fully mastered a language to be creative or expressive in that language. So in the book, I'm using it as this metaphorical way to think more flexibly and also expansively about the different purposes for why we might change something when we move artistic or cultural elements from one context to another. And, you know, how images or ideas can be shaped by the experience of being somewhere new. In the book, and in the introduction, I define transposition as a creative strategy. So it's a strategy that emphasizes how artistic difference or change, variation, it's actually something desirable, right? It's mm-hmm. kind of like the desired end result or the objective. And I think, you know, thinking about art through this lens can show us, you know, why writers and artists would want to adapt and borrow and kind of incorporate these recognizable iconic markers of Chinese cultural identity. So in this sense, I think transposition can be a helpful alternative to translation, which again, like, requires some level of linguistic fluency. I think transposition can better account for this fluid movement of text and images among different media, different languages and national modes. And then it helps us think about, you know, why certain things were recognizable overseas, and then also why certain elements were transformed in these new contexts.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you're saying this, I'm thinking about, you know, legibility in a mm-hmm. way, and mm-hmm. what was and what became legible to different audiences as the painters, the artists, the writers moved from one sphere into another, or decided to stay in one place, or you know, for a period of time, or then changed location. So what became adapted for legibility and what it meant for them as well, themselves.
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that gets us to chapter two, Changyu and the Pose, because here the chapter brings to light Changyu's work and discusses the concept of pose, both as an element in his paintings, as well as a cultural element in the artist's practice and identity. And I think this is where, you know, this idea of legibility and transposition that you theorize comes in specifically. And I wanted to invite you to tell us more about Changyu's negotiations between elements of nationality and ethnicity through his art while making himself, visible to different audiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the painter Changyu, who is originally trained in classical calligraphy, and then he traveled to Paris as an art student in 1921, and there he was referred to as the Chinese Matisse, right? So this was like a very common practice during this time where, certain figures would be referred to as like the Chinese version of some existing, usually French, you know, literary or art celebrity. So I'm really curious about why his career has always been described as mistimed or misplaced. And I think that by, you know, looking at his very unique self-positioning as this Chinese painter living in Paris, we can kind of understand how he attempted to work outside the state institutions, and then how he was trying to reconfigure modern Chinese visual language and having that freedom to do so in France. So it was kind of slightly, from afar and removed. I read mostly his oil paintings of female nudes and his chrysanthemum paintings as transpositions. And also he has these engravings that he made, three engravings for the poet Liang Zongdai's translations of Tao Qian's classical kind of recluse poetry. So all of these projects really kind of gesture back to his training, I think, in classical Chinese calligraphy. And my chapter actually begins with this poem that he composed, which is really unique as well. So he painted this poem on a mirror, and it's about the chrysanthemum flower in France that are used to decorate graves. And then he compares them to their symbolic meaning in celebrating long life in China during Zhongyangjie, the double ninth festival. So I think this poem is like a really great example of what I mean by transposition, because this same chrysanthemum flower that has like seemingly drastically different cultural implications in France and China, and if we think about where does Changyu himself, the artist, fit in the picture, you know, is he the Chinese poet who's praising this chrysanthemum flower in his poetry? Is it possible? And I have to thank my mentor, Steve West from ASU, for suggesting this possibility, that maybe Changyu feels some connection to the chrysanthemum flower itself, right? Something that's transplanted from a place where he is appreciated and celebrated to this new place as a kind of decorative ornament. So my chapter really looks at how his experiences as this male Chinese expat artist, this was a persona that he really cultivated and crafted, especially, you know, as he communicated back with his colleagues and his friends in China, and also the Chinese students and artists that were traveling to Paris from China. You know, everybody knew he was there. And all of this was closely connected to this kind of new visual language that was he was creating in his nude paintings and his still lifes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's really interesting, because you know chrysanthemum holds different meanings, but also related to life and death in multiple cultures, and it's very interesting how he in a way connected with this, the symbol and, you know, the flower itself, and started to connect his practice with.
I think it's kind of surprising that like those would be, I mean, he had so many illustrations and also paintings, but, you know, we think of like the female nude as kind of this huge marker of, you know, Western modernism. And he was, you know, fully engaged in that. But at the same time, he was producing these still lifes of so many different flower arrangements, especially the chrysanthemum. So I'm interested in how he plays with these different kind of icons of Chinese literary tradition.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And the poem is amazing. So, and yeah,
it's so fascinating. I mean, it seems like so simple, but it's just like really fascinating to me.
Me too. And the painting, right? The nude is so, and you managed to get to put it in the book, like the full page. So that was really, really nice to see.
Yes, I was really pleased with the press, and they were so supportive of all of these images. I mean, it was really important to me to have all of these color images. So I'm just really grateful that I was able to get all the image permissions and then have the resources to include them in the final product. So really
happy about that. I'm very happy too. And I'm sure the readers are very happy as well to actually see the painting that you describe very well. But, you know, reading and seeing can go very well together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's not the only chapter where you included images or poems. And of course, chapter 3 follows suit, and it's entitled Foulet the Critic. And here, you know, we see this modern Chinese art critic and the ways in which he positioned himself both in China and in France. And mm-hmm. his letters are of crucial importance. And of course, you know, we can talk about the epistolary genre as well. But it was more his the letters themselves that highlighted different types of transpositions. Mm-hmm. And here, you know, I think it would be important to talk about the steps Foulet took to inhabit his position as an art critic at the intersection of multiple cultural traditions.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, usually the discussion of Foulet's impact on Chinese literary historiography is framed in terms of his contributions to translation of French literature, and then also his very famous letters to his son Fu Tong in his Foulet Jiashu. So my chapter is trying to explore like some of his less studied writings. So as you mentioned, some of those are his letters, but also his essays of art criticism, for instance, his promotion of the avant-garde work of the artist Peng Xunqing, and then also his theorization about this crisis of modern Chinese art. So what I tried to do in chapter 3 is to read these essays alongside some of his the travel letters that you mentioned, where he's sharing his experiences as a young Chinese student who's abroad for the very first time in Paris. And I think for Foulet, transposition works as a way to make sense of some of these conflicts or contradictions. And he's trying to see how these contradictions can be artistically productive. So he finds a lot of meaning in these encounters by being in Paris, whether he's observing kind of discrepancies or connections. He's able to transpose these familiar elements of classical literary tradition in order to show how, you know, they can still be relevant in Paris, but then also to point out some of the possible artistic limitations. So one of the essays that I discuss in my chapter is his 1931 essay, which is about his friend and colleague, the artist Liu Haisu. So Foulet is really great at bringing in a lot of references to all sorts of other different literatures. So he starts with this quote by Rilke's biography of the sculptor Rodin, and talking about how Rodin, even though he was famous, he was surrounded by the sense of total misunderstanding. And, you know, this is how Foulet understood his friend Liu Haisu's status as someone who, and this is in Foulé's words, someone who interacted with everyone in the world, somebody who had mentored students all over China, but was still misunderstood, not only by his enemies, but worse, by his friends. So Foulé observed that, you know, even though Liu Haisu was already so famous at this time, the fact that everybody knew his work and his art from all over the world, this made him even feel more isolated. So in some cases, that kind of increased visibility didn't lead to increased legibility. You know, earlier you were mentioning this legibility, right? So it didn't actually like increase people's understanding of him, but actually decrease the understanding. So I use this phrase "turn back" in the book to describe Foulé's image of the ideal artist, because he believed that the best position for the artist was to stay kind of physically removed or at a distance from reality. But, you know, based on all of the writings that we see during this period as a student abroad, you know, even though he was able to travel and detach himself physically, we don't have any sense that this guaranteed his spiritual or emotional detachment. So, you know, numerous times in his letters, he's still trying to distance himself from these guilty thoughts of what's happening back in China. And this idea of like turning back to one's national soul is really necessary, I think, in the work of a true artist, at least according to Foulé. So even later, you know, thinking back to his time abroad, and this is in his letter to his son, Fu Tong, he always insisted that he learned to truly love Chinese art by studying Western art at the Louvre. I'm not sure if that's true, but that's how he remembered it. So I thought that was really interesting that he linked this source of misunderstanding to kind of exposure and visibility gained by travel and circulation, especially in the case of Liu Haisu's art. But, you know, again, like it always kind of relied on returning back to China from overseas, and then dealing with a kind of misunderstanding back in China as well.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was also thinking, as I was reading the chapter, I was also thinking about, you know, those periods that I think we all encountered where you go back to a place either of origin or a place that you know very well. And then there's this period where you kind of get your bearings, you know, you get your footing there. And for him, it really sounded like that in a way, to this going back to China and then being misunderstood, but, you know, not acknowledging for these transition periods of kind of recognition and misrecognition of something that is familiar.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's a kind of like adjustment that needs to happen to get resituated. And I think, you know, maybe we can speculate that that's why some of these people, you know, chose not to go back.
Possibly. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think maybe there might be letters about this. Who knows?
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, continuing on a similar note, we, in chapter 4, Li Jinfa and the Muse, we discover Li Jinfa, who's a poet whose artistic project was to challenge traditional understandings of poetry and poetry writing practices. And I'm pretty sure that in his practice, he outraged, you know, Li Bai and the others, right? I was wondering, how did Li Jinfa position himself in relation to Chinese literary tradition, and how is that indicative of his relation and or relationship with French culture, for that matter?
I think Li Jinfa, you know, the subject of chapter 4, he's probably the most challenging figure in my book in terms of trying to figure out how to situate his artistic legacy. So, you know, he never composed poetry or even studied French language prior to his trip to France in 1919. So he went there fully with the intention to study sculpture. And, you know, in terms of like poetry and criticism, he was called a language criminal in the 80s. And a lot of his critics have interpreted his poems as, just mistranslations or very poor imitations of French symbolist poetry. So, for instance, the poet Biendeling described his experimental poetry as an utter failure. He faced these very harsh critiques, even though people like Lu Xun's brother, Zhou Zuoren, did help him publish his poetry in the 1920s. So, in my chapter, I'm proposing that, by using this concept of transposition, we can maybe better understand Li Jingfa's experimental strategy in his poems, such as this 1926 bilingual poem, Chat with Verlaine. And this is a poem that borrows lines from Paul Verlaine's 19th century French poem, Oh mon Dieu, vous m'avez blessé d'amour, which was published in his collection Sagesse in 1881. And in Li Jingfa's kind of version of this, he's created this imaginary dialogue that alternates between the French language lines that are taken directly from Verlaine's poem, which is about conversion back to Catholicism. And then he's, kind of place these with the Chinese language lines that he's created to form this imaginary dialogue. So I think, it's a very shocking kind of project, because it challenges this idea of artistic inspiration. So that's why I'm interested in this figure of the muse, because he also had this kind of fever dream in which this muse came and saved him. So, this notion that somebody, the poet can receive a kind of individual inspiration, and then, anybody without proper literary or language training can be a poet. Like you said, this could be perceived as an act of betrayal to the literary establishment, right? If we think about all of these poets who, work so hard on their literary training, and then here he's saying that, okay, this kind of inspiration can just come to anybody. I think it's very shocking. Of course, there's this issue again of legibility. So, it's very difficult to understand these poems. So what can we make of them? So those are some of the questions that I'm addressing in the chapter. And it really was a challenge to translate his poems in that sense.
Absolutely, I'm sure. And he's very playful in a way, from what I perceived, right? And to be able to convey that playfulness, it's a challenge in itself.
Yeah, and I think a lot of these critics were just saying the way that he is transposing French poetry, I think he's using that same strategy to also play with classical Chinese poetry as well, right? So he's using these certain words and structures, but taking them out of that context and placing them in this entirely new kind of form that's just seen as very shocking. Yeah.
Yeah, I just have I don't know, this is just my own image. And of course, you don't have to agree with it, but I totally see, Li Bai or the others just, rolling in their graves.
Yes, I definitely see that. Yes, I agree.
it's a very important, joke aside, it's a very important artistic project that absolutely becomes clearer through the lens of the transposition, and put in connection with the others, right? Like with Fulei, as you do, or with Chang Yu, or just having this context and having the others, right, as points of the network, his project becomes way clearer to us now, in a way. And, you know, I think we can continue the conversation with what Xu tried to, mm-hmm. to do. And here, chapter 5, entitled Xu and the Artist's Studio, takes us back in a way to travel writing. And of course, that's very broadly defined. But also to this time, time where, you know, in China. And the Artist's Studio is the center of attention here and allows us to think about ambiguity for most of the time, and positionality, but also shifting perceptions of Chinese art in France and French art in China. So I was wondering, how does he navigate all of this through his short stories?
Yeah, so his Xu's travel stories, they really highlight this abstract notion of the Oriental sentiment, Dongfang Qingdiao, that I mentioned earlier, and its potential role in cross-cultural romance. So the stories by Xu, they're semi-fictional. They're often interpreted as semi-autobiographical. So for Xu's characters, especially his first-person male protagonists, who always seem suspiciously similar to Xu, right? These characters show us how, you know, they're able to be romantically and sexually victorious. So in Xu's imagining, this Chinese aesthetic expertise is desired and appreciated in Paris. So I focus on the site of the Artist Studio in Montparnasse, the bohemian artsy neighborhood in Paris. And it's depicted as this microcosm of intercultural encounters and romance. So, you know, Xu's transposition of classical Chinese art and poetry in these fictional stories show that this modern Wenren or literati kind mm-hmm. of type mm-hmm. has something to offer, you know, in the space of Paris. They can offer their specialized expertise. They have special knowledge and skill over their Western European white male rivals in that cultural sphere. And they're being appreciated and desired by both, you know, the Chinese women who are also studying abroad in Paris, as well as the French and European women there as well. So, you know, I think we can read this as a kind of romanticization of the positive reception of Chinese culture in France, or, you know, also at the same time, a kind of disillusionment with French culture on its wane. So Xu seems a little bit unsure about how to feel about French society not fulfilling his extremely high expectations. And there's a sense in his writing that the, you know, the great revolutionary period is over in France. So there's an uncertainty about the future. And we can infer, I think, in Xu's writing, kind of anxiety and uncertainty about a parallel situation in terms of what's happening in China in the late 1940s as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. And a lot was happening at the time,
yes,
right?
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But also in Paris, you know, things were not as stable, right? In the,
exactly.
In the 40s.
Exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. During World War II. So a lot happening then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that leads us to just like questioning, you know, the perceptions of right stability, but also exchanges, and also the universality of Paris, as you entitled chapter 6. And here we meet Pan Yuliang's work, and we find more details that complicated the formation of her reputation. And this is more an invitation than a question, but I wanted to hear more about her artistic work and the quintessential role in conceptualizing transposition as a heuristic for Sino-French cultural exchanges, more than, you know, what we've seen in chapters like 2 or 3, where we are talking about particular examples in a way. Mm-hmm. I think this chapter just takes us to the meta, like way mm-hmm. more, like higher level in mm-hmm. a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this last chapter on Panyuryang, I added this new chapter when I was revising my manuscript. So my reviewers pointed out, and they were completely right in doing so, that, you know, my project was centered on these four male Han figures. And so they suggested adding another perspective, and I'm so glad that I did. Mm-hmm. You know, this suggestion was made to me during the review process, and it was right when they suggested that I thought of Panyuryang, because mm-hmm. I had already considered her story when I was writing my dissertation, but at the time I didn't feel like I could find enough materials. Mm-hmm. And so in the time that had passed, you know, since I worked on my dissertation, when this book came out, I was really pleasantly surprised that a lot more had come out and also become more accessible online. So I was really happy to continue this research. And, you know, it made me appreciate her situation as a Chinese woman artist in France, how challenging that must have been, and how she had to work with these added pressures. And, you know, what is really remarkable is that instead of, you know, hiding away, she really chose to present herself in this very public way of self-portraiture. So, you know, chapter five is called Speculating Panyuryang, with this double meaning, both in terms of how much speculation there was about her biological kind of biography, her background, her origin story, this, you know, bootstrapping story of her association with being raised in a brothel after her parents died, mm-hmm. before she was taken on as this concubine by her husband. And then, you know, secondly, these images of her as a woman painter that circulated, you know, in mainstream media, and used as proof of her very worldly experiences traveling back and forth from China and Europe. So, you know, this word speculating, I think in the title, refers to the connection between speculation and spectatorship. Mm-hmm. So For Panyuryang, this practice of self-portraiture in Shanghai and also Paris became this way for her to transpose some of these photographic and textual images of the modern Chinese woman artist. I look at a series of her self-portraits to show how she was very actively engaging with these other images of the modern woman artist in Chinese media. And she was presenting this more kind of personal, private, realist view that challenged, you know, some of the established and new ways of depicting the woman's body. So, you know, the portraits highlight the woman's body still in the public sphere, but, you know, not as a nude in the work of Tang Yu, or, you know, not as a photo that could be publicly critiqued or consumed or used, but really more as a way to document everyday life. So I read these self-portraits as transpositions of this very public nature of the woman artist status as a kind of visual spectacle in alternative ways other than the nude or abstraction. So I think this chapter really speaks back to the nude paintings by Chang Yu in chapter two.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And it definitely positions, like the two chapters, right, are positioned as in dialogue. After going through, you know, chapter three, four, and five, we go back to this dialogue and to seeing how transposition and how rethinking one's place and maybe identity, right, in two or more spaces will change also artistic practices.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yep. And, you know, I have more questions, but, you know, we already have taken a lot of your time. And, you know, I was just wondering whether you could tell us more about your current projects.
Sure. So I'm excited to start a new project on food and cultural authenticity and examples of kind of gastro diplomacy. So I'm interested in this figure of Fu Peimei, who was this Wai Shen Ren, like Taiwan TV chef in the 1960s. And she had this cooking TV show. So, you know, I grew up with my mom, like having all of her cookbooks. I was thinking about how food becomes this way of, you know, maintaining some sort of connection to homeland. And also I'm looking into some other figures such as Cecilia Chang, who is this Bay Area Chinese chef that inspired Alice Waters, and Wang Wang made a documentary about a documentary film about her work called Soul of a Banquet. So linking that to kind of recent Hollywood film depictions of Chinese food and, you know, looking at ideas of changing tastes and this idea of cooking and eating in Chinese that Yang Buwei talks about. So it reminds me of this headline description of Chang Yu as an artist who paints neither in Chinese nor French. So taking these modes of like cultural expression that are not exactly linguistically based, but thinking about how they can still convey notions of you know, Chinese cultural identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fascinating. And as we have more and more you know, representations coming out of Hollywood, out of Disney, out of, you know, all of these, I think it's so important to see how they change and how they how they speak to different culture formations. But you know, I'm looking forward to the book that will come out of this project and to different other presentations and articles, and I really hope to have you back on New Books Network soon.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me today.
Absolutely. Thank you for talking to us, and we'll get back soon here.